Seminar 26, Wednesday, 18th of June, 1958. The 18th of June is also the anniversary of the foundation of the Société Française de Psychanalyse. There was a moment when we too said no. The last time I had begun to comment on the observation of a female obsessional who was being treated by one of our colleagues, and I had begun to outline some of the principles which can be deduced about the way in which we try to articulate things as regards the good or bad direction, the correct or incorrect character of the conduct of a treatment centered on something which obviously presents itself as existing in the content of what emerges in analysis, namely the conscious awareness, prise de conscience of penis envy. I think that in general you can see the importance of the use that we make of it. There are, of course, always some little delays when you see, when you are upset, because the schemas which you were concentrating on, the oppositions which seem to you to be easy to hold on to, find themselves somewhat shaken or put in question by what is revealed as we make further progress. We only have to ask ourselves, for example, if there is not a contradiction between what I put forward the last time and a principle on which some people wanted to concentrate. I said that in fact, for the woman, her sexual development passed necessarily through something which could be described as, she must be the phallus against the background of not being it, I said. For the man, it is the castration complex which can be formulated as follows, that he has the phallus against the background of the fact that he does not have it, or is threatened with not having it. Obviously, there are schemas which from a certain angle and when one speaks of, when one opposes sexual development at one or other phase, may well show a certain opposition. It is quite insufficient to stop at this because it is also the case that this dialectic of being and having and of having holds for both. The man also must realize that he is not it. It is even in fact in this very direction that we can see situated one part of the problems brought into operation by the solution of the castration complex and of penis envy. We are going to examine it in greater detail, and I hope that little by little you will put in their place things which are not false in themselves, but which are partial views. To do this, let us start again today from our schema. It is extremely important to articulate correctly the different lines on which analysis is situated. There is an article which I would recommend you to read. It is the article by Glover, which is called The Therapeutic Effect of Inexact Interpretation. October 1931, Volume 12, Article 4 of the International Journey of Psychoanalysis. It is one of the most remarkable and most intelligent articles which could be written on such a subject. It is really, in fact, the starting base from which the question of interpretation can be approached. In fact, the basis of this article and of the problem that it poses is something which can more or less be situated as follows. At the point in time that Glover wrote it, we are still at a time when Freud is alive, but at which the great change of analytic technique around analysis of resistances and of aggressivity has happened. Glover articulates that this analysis of resistances and of transference is something which, with the experience and the development of notions acquired in analysis, is something which implies going over, covering, as one might say, in the sense that ground must be covered by the analytic progress, the totality of the systems fantasmatique, let us translate fantasy systems in this way. The systems of fantasies which we have learned to recognize in analysis. It is clear that at that time more had been learned, more was known than right at the beginning of analysis, and the question which is posed is, what was our therapy when we did not know the whole extent, the whole range of these fantasy systems? Does it mean that what we did at that time were incomplete therapeutic treatments less worthwhile than those which we are carrying out now? It is obviously a very interesting question. in connection with which he is led in a way to draw up a kind of general report on all the positions articulated, taken up by the one who finds himself in the position of being consulted about any difficulties whatsoever. In a certain way he generalizes, he extends the notion of interpretation to every articulated position taken by the person who is consulted, and he draws up a table of the different positions of the doctor with regard to the patient. There is here an anticipation of the doctor-patient relationship, as it is called today, but really articulated in a way which makes me regret that it was not developed in this direction, which sets out a sort of general approach. The fact is very precisely that insofar as we overlook the truth included in the symptom, we find ourselves by this very fact collaborating with the symptomatic formation. He takes this first from the position of the general practitioner who says to the patient, get a grip on yourself, take a holiday, change your job. In fact, who puts himself in the position of miscognition. Right away he occupies a certain place, which is not an ineffective one, because it is one which is situated, can be very precisely located at the very place that certain symptoms are formed. He immediately occupies a certain function with respect to the patient, which can be situated in the very terms of analytic topography. I will not insist on this. He remarks at one point that the whole trend of modern psychoanalytic therapy in his time is the direction of interpreting both what he calls sadistic systems and guilt reactions. He remarks that up to recent times all this was not stressed. The patient was no doubt relieved of his anxiety, but there were undoubtedly left unresolved in him, unsuppressed and at the same time repressed, this famous sadistic system. Here, for example, is an example of the direction in which he does not conclude his remarks but begins them, and it is this that in our own day it would be interesting to take up again. In this precise connection I will make a remark. It would be, in sum, a question of situating what is meant by the advent of the analysis of aggressivity. For a certain time, analysts were so impressed by the discovery that they had made of it, that it had become a sort of answer to everything. Our aggressivity was so well analyzed that the words that analysts' information encountered one another with tell the story. It would be a question of knowing what in effect this discovery represented, and I think that we can situate it somewhere on our fundamental schema. This is what I tried to do above, because in fact we too can pose certain questions about it. I often remarked how much ambiguity remained at the time that I was teaching you, that I was talking to you about the narcissistic system as such, as fundamental in the formation of aggressive reactions, that aggressivity, the one that is provoked in the imaginary relationship to the small other, and is something that can be confused with the totality of aggressive power, as a vital function and imaginary relationship. On the other hand, it is clear to recall very obvious things that violence is indeed what is essential in aggression, at least if we situate ourselves on the human plane. It is not the word. It is even exactly its contrary. It is violence or the word which can appear in an interhuman relationship. If violence is something in its essence which is distinguished from the word, the question can be posed of knowing in what measure violence as such, I say violence in order to distinguish it from the use that we make of aggressivity, can be repressed, because if we follow what we have here posed as a principle, that in principle there can only be repressed what is revealed as illuminated by the structure of the word, namely by a signifying articulation, this is a question that must be posed. In effect, from the imaginary angle, it is from the angle of this murder of the counterpart which is latent in the imaginary relationship as such, that what is of the order of aggressivity comes to be symbolized, and as such taken up in the mechanism of repression, of what belongs to the unconscious, of what is analyzable, of what is even, you can say in a general fashion, interpretable. Let us take things up properly once again. If we follow and if we begin again, if we spell out again our little schema or schema in its simplest form. namely in the intersection of the tendency, the drive, if you wish, insofar as it represents an individualized need, and is something which is the signifying chain in which it must come to articulate itself. By itself, what is it? This already gives us some elements and allows us to make some remarks. Let us make a supposition. Let us suppose that for the human being there is only reality, this famous reality that we can make use of in all sorts of circumstances. Let us suppose that there is only that. It is not unthinkable that something signifying should articulate this reality. To fix your ideas, let us suppose that, as they sometimes like to put it in some schools, the signifier is simply a conditioning. I would not say of reflexes, but of this something which is reducible to reflexes, as if language was not something of a different order to what we artificially create in the laboratory with animals, by teaching them to secrete gastric juices at the sound of a bell. The sound of the bell is a signifier, and one can suppose a human world that is entirely organized around the coalescence of each of the needs which have to harmonize with a certain number of predetermined signs. If the signs are valid for all, in principle, this should give us a society which functions in a perfectly ideal fashion. Every instinctual discharge of the order of need will be associated with something which we will call, if you wish, the differently varied sounds of the bell, which will function in a fashion appropriate to the one who hears it, so that immediately he may satisfy the aforesaid need. We thus arrive at the ideal society. I would like to point out what I am outlining is what has always been dreamt of by utopians, a society functioning perfectly and culminating in the satisfaction of each one according to his needs, with everyone it is added participated in it according to their merits. This is where the problems begin. In fact, if this schema remains at this level of the intersection of the signifier and the pressure or the tendency of the need, what does it culminate in? At the identification of the subject to the big other, insofar as this big other articulates the distribution of what can respond to need, the distribution of resources. This is precisely what already shows you that it is not like that, namely that it is absolutely necessary that this background of demand should be taken into account, simply in order to take into account what happens if, in this articulation of the subject, in the subject's is taking up a position in an order which exists beyond the order of the real, and which we call the symbolic order, which complicates it, which is superimposed on it, which does not belong to it. Here and now, however, at this level, at this simple state of the schema, we can see that at this level already something is happening, something in the natural order, in the organic order, let us say at least in man, which complicates the schema simply at this stage that is here described on the blackboard, and which consists in the following. It is that here we have the subject, this mythical child, let us stress, whom we use as a sort of background for our psychoanalytic speculations. This child in the presence of his mother who begins to manifest his needs. It is here that he encounters the mother as a speaking subject. It is here that this message culminates, namely at the point where the mother satisfies him. As I pointed out to you, it is not when the mother does not satisfy him, frustrates him, that the problems begin. This would be too simply, even though, of course, people constantly try to come back to it, precisely because it is simple. I told you the interesting problem, one which did not escape someone like Winnicott, for example, whom we know to be someone whose thinking and whose practice covers the whole breadth of the present-day development of psychoanalysis and its techniques, up to and including an extremely precise consideration of the fantasy systems which are at the limit, at the frontier with psychosis. Winnicott, in his article on transitional sub-objects, which I brought to your attention, shows with the greatest precision that the essential problem is how the infant emerges from satisfaction, and not from frustration, to construct the world. The fact is that, insofar as a world is articulated for the human subject, which involves a beyond of demand, when the demand is satisfied, and not when it is frustrated, this is what he calls transitional objects. namely these small objects that we very early see taking on an extreme importance in the relationship with the mother, namely a piece of a blanket that he jealously pulls on, a piece of anything at all, a trinket. At the importance of this transitional object in the developmental system of the child is something absolutely essential to see and to situate and to understand in its precociousness. This having been said, let us focus on this frustration, namely on the fact that here the message does not arrive there after a date that we tried to fix when we were interested, 3 years ago in the mirror stage. It has not evaporated since. I really like those of you who tell me, every year it is something different, the system changes. It does not change. I'm simply trying to make you go over the whole field. What we find is that what happens in this relationship with the mother, insofar as here the mother imposes what I called more than once her law, her omnipotence or her caprice, complicated by the fact that the child, the human child, and not every little animal, and we know it from experience, is open to a certain relationship of the imaginary order, which is the relationship to the image of his own body, and to the image of the other, namely insofar as we see it on our schema, in the beyond of what happens on the return line of the satisfied or unsatisfied need. Namely that he experiences reactions, for example, of disappointment, of malaise, of vertigo in his own body, compared to an ideal image that he has of it, and which takes on for him an altogether predominant value because of a feature of his organization which we have linked more or less correctly to the prematurity of his birth. In short, from the beginning you see, if you wish, interfering, interacting between one another, two circuits, the first of which is the symbolic circuit to fix your ideas, to hang things on a clothes stand that you already know, the infantile feminine superego, and on the other, the imaginary relationship to this ideal self-image, which is found in him when he is frustrated or disappointed, more or less affected, even injured. In other words, from the beginning the circuit is found to act on two planes, the symbolic plane and the imaginary plane. The relationship to the image of the primordial object, the mother, the big other, insofar as she is the locus where there is situated the possibility of articulating need in the signifier, and on the other hand the image of the other, small o, insofar as it is the point where the subject has this sort of link with himself, with an image which represents what we can call the line of his completion, imaginary completion of course. In what has all we have said since the beginning of the year consisted, since we began to take things at the level of the witticism? In having the opportunity of putting forward the schema of showing you its pertinence, its inevitable character in mental states, I told you that in fact no mental life could be organized which corresponds to what we are given in experience, to what experience articulates in analysis, if there is not beyond this other, primordially placed in the position of omnipotence through its power, not of frustration, because that is insufficient, but of versagum, with ambiguity of promise and of refusal, that is contained in this term versagum, that there is, I might say, the other of this other, namely what permits this other locus of the word, which the subject perceives it as itself symbolized, namely that there is this other of the other. On the occasion when we take the system of the family Oedipal triangle, if you wish, you see clearly that there is something more radical, more fundamental than anything that is given by social experience. This term family, and this indeed is what constitutes the permanence, I mean the constancy of this Oedipal triangle and of Freudian discovery. I told you that here the father with a capital F, insofar as he is never a father, but much more rather the dead father, the father qua bearer of a signifier as such, a second degree signifier, of a signifier which authorizes and founds the whole system of the signifier, which ensures that in a way the first other, namely the first subject to which the speaking individual addresses itself, is herself symbolized. It is uniquely at the level of this other of the law properly speaking, and of a law, and I am going to insist on it, that is incarnated, that the articulated human world can take on its proper dimension as we see it operating in experience, and such that experience shows it to be absolutely indispensable, this backdrop of an other with respect to the other, without which the universe of language, as it shows itself efficacious in the structuring, not only of needs, but of this new thing whose original dimension I am trying to make you understand, to demonstrate to you this year, and which is called desire, to be articulated. It is at this level that there is perceived at the level of the other qua locus of the word, this other which could be purely and simply the locus of the sound of the bell that I talked to you about above, which would not therefore, properly speaking, be another, but simply the organized locus of this system of signifiers introducing its order and its regularity into the vital exchanges with a certain species. It is hard to see who could have organized it. And after all, one can envisage that in a particular society, men who are full of benevolence spend their time organizing it and making it function. It can even be said that it is one of the ideals of modern politics. Only the other is not that. It is precisely not purely and simply the locus which is this something perfectly organized, fixed, rigid. It is an other which is itself symbolized. This is what gives it its appearance of liberty. It is a fact that it is symbolized, and that what happens at this level of the other, namely of the Father in this instance, of the locus where the law is articulated from the point of the perspective of him, who depends on another, this other is itself subjected to signifying articulation, more than subjected to signifying articulation, marked by something which is the denaturing effect. Let us strongly underline it, of our thinking of this presence of the signifier, which is still far from having arrived at the state of perfect articulation that we take here as a sort of starting hypothesis, simply to illustrate our thought of this effect of the signifier on the other as such, of this mark of it that it was subjected to at this level. It is this mark that represents castration as such. If we have formerly, in the castration, frustration, privation triad, clearly marked in castration that the action is symbolic, that the agent is real, that one needs a real father, that castration exists, that castration is a symbolic action, and that it bears on something imaginary. We find here the necessity for this. It is insofar as something passes from the real to the level of the law, a more or less inadequate father, it does not matter, or something which replaces him, but something which holds his place, that this is produced. The fact is that there is reflected in the system of demand, in the system of demand where the subject establishes himself, this something which is its background, namely which marks in this system of demand, far from being articulated, far from being perfect, but far from being fully productive or fully used. Which marks in its background is something which is called the effect of the signifier on the subject, the marking of the subject by the signifier, the lack, the dimension of lack introduced into the subject by the signifier. This lack which is introduced is symbolized as such in the system of the signifier as being the effect of the signifier on the subject. The signified, properly speaking, the signified, which does not come, as one might say, so much from the depths, as if life abounded in significations, but which comes from elsewhere, from language and from the signifier as such, in order to imprint on it this sort of effect which is called signified. This is symbolized primitively, as is indicated by what we have put forward about castration, the fact that what emerges as a support for the symbolic action properly speaking, which is called castration, is an image chosen, as one might say, in the imaginary system to be its support, this something in which the symbolic action of castration chooses its sign. It is borrowed from the imaginary domain, something in the image of the other is chosen to carry the mark of a lack, which is this very lack through which the living being perceives himself, because he is human, namely because he is in relationship with language, perceives himself as excluded from the totality of desires, as something limited, local, as a creature, in this instance as a link in the chain of life, as only being one of those through whom life passes, unlike the animal, who is only effectively one of those who realizes the type, who in this sense can be considered by us as in relationship to the type, each individual as already dead. We ourselves are also already dead for them. We are already dead with regard to the movement itself, this movement itself of life, which because of language we are capable of projecting in its totality, and even more, in its totality as having arrived at its end. It is exactly what Freud articulates in the notion of death instinct. He means that for man, life here and now is projected as having arrived at its term, namely at the point at which it returns to death. This articulation by Freud of the death instinct is the articulation of a position essential to an animal being who is caught up and articulated in a signifying system which permits him to dominate his immanence as a living being, and to perceive himself as already dead. It is exactly what precisely he does, only in an imaginary fashion, I mean here as virtual, as at limit, as speculative. There is no experience of death, of course, which can correspond to it, and this is the very reason that it is symbolized in a different fashion. It is symbolized on this point and on this precise organ where there appears in the most obvious fashion the thrust of life. That is the reason that it is the phallus insofar as it represents simply the rise of a vital power which takes its place in the order of signifiers, in order to represent for the human individual in his existence that which is marked by the signifier, that which is struck by the signifier with this essential caducity, in which there can be articulated the signifier itself, this lack of being whose dimension the signifier introduces into the life of the subject. This is what allows us to understand the order in which things were presented for analysis. Once someone simply did not start from academic considerations in order to approach the phenomenon, but simply started with the phenomena as he saw them manifesting themselves in neurotics, a privileged terrain for manifesting this articulation in its essence, simply because of the fact that it shows it in its disorder. And experience has proved that it was always in disorder, that we should learn to find rather easily the machinery and the articulations of order. We can say that what is first given by Freud to an experience which, immediately put in the foreground, promoted to the underpinning of the castration complex as such. This is something which everyone knows, started from the apprehension and the perception of the symptoms of the subject. What does the symptom mean? Where it is situated in the schema? It is situated somewhere in small s between brackets capital O, which is produced at the level of signification. It is essentially the whole of what Freud put forward. It is a symptom. It is a signification. A symptom is a signified, it is a signified which is very far from involving only the subject. It is his history, his whole anamnesis that is implied. That is the reason that one can legitimately symbolize it at this place by little s between brackets capital O, which means a signifier, sick, of the big other, coming as such from the locus of the word. But what Freud taught us also is that the symptom is never simple. The symptom is always overdetermined. There is no symptom whose signifier is not brought from a previous experience, precisely from an experience situated at a level where it is a question of what is suppressed, réprimé, and of what is the heart of all that is suppressed in the subject, namely the castration complex of the signifier of capital O, which is something which, without any doubt, is articulated in the castration complex, but which is not necessarily nor always totally articulated there. The famous trauma from which we started, the famous primitive scene, what is it, if it is not precisely something which enters into the economy of the subject, and which operates at the heart, at the horizon of the discovery of the unconscious, always as a signifier insofar as it is defined in its incidence, as I began to articulate it above, namely that life, I mean the living being, grasps as living qua living, but with this separation, this distance, which is precisely what constitutes this autonomy of the signifying dimension, the trauma or the primitive scene. What is it therefore, if not this life which grasps itself in a horrible perception of itself, in its total strangeness, in its opaque brutality, as pure signifier of an existence intolerable for life itself, once it separates itself from it to see the trauma and the primitive scene. This is what appears of life to itself as signifier in the pure state, namely as something which cannot yet in any fashion be resolved, be articulated. This necessity, this backdrop of the signifier with respect to signified, this is the something which, from the beginning, once Freud began to articulate what the symptom is implicated by him in the formation of every symptom, and what have we recently seen in the hysteric, if it is not this which permits us to situate where the problem of the neurotic is found. It is a problem of the relationship of the signifier with his position as subject depending on the demand. It is that in which the hysteric has to articulate something which we will provisionally call her desire, and the object of this desire, insofar precisely as it is not the object of need. That is the reason that I insisted somewhat on what I called the dream of the butcher's beautiful wife. What is it that we are dealing with? It appears there in quite a clear fashion, and Freud says it in the beginning, from the very dawn of psychoanalysis, that it is a question for the hysteric of setting up, of making the object of desire subsist as distinction and independent, as distinct and independent from the object of any need. Again, of making the object of desire subsist as distinct and independent from the object of any need. This relationship to desire, to the constitution, to the maintenance in its enigmatic form of desire as such as a backdrop to every demand, this is the problem of the hysteric. And everyone knows that this, namely, if you like, something which we have called X, the unsayable desire. What is the desire of my hysteric? It is that I should open up for her. I will not say the universe, but the whole world which is already vast enough, namely the dimension that can be called the dimension of hysteria latent in every human being in the world, namely everything that can present itself as a question about his own desire. Here is what the hysteric finds herself communicating with on an equal footing. First of all, of course, with everything of this order which can be happening among all her hysterical brothers and sisters, namely that it is on this, as Freud articulates for us, that hysterical identification reposes. To every hysteric there echoes everything which, in actuality, is posed in some others, whether it is as questions about her own desire, especially and insofar as this other is hysterical, but also insofar as it is only a hysterical mode of posing a question in someone who may only occasionally and even in a latent fashion be hysterical. The world is opened up to the hysteric through this question about her desire, a world of identification which puts her, as one might say, properly speaking, in a certain relationship with the mask, I mean with everything which can in any way fix, symbolize according to a certain type, this question about desire which relates it to the hysteric. Let us say here to the appeal to hysterics as such, which makes her essentially identified to a sort of general mask under which stir all the possible modes of lack. We have now come to the obsessional. The structure of the obsessional, as I am trying to advance in it, I told you, is also designated by a certain relationship with desire, which is not this relationship, little d slash x, which is the different relationship which I already indicated to you as being essential for him, which we will call, if you wish today, little d small o. The relationship of the obsessional to his desire is subject to something which we have long known thanks to Freud, namely the precocious role played in him by what is called Triebenmischung, the diffusion of the drives, the isolation of something which is called destruction. It is insofar as the first approach of the desire of the obsessional subject was, as for every other subject, the contribution of the desire of the other, and that this desire of the other was first of all and as such destroyed, cancelled, that the whole structure of the obsessional is entered into, and that it is as such and uniquely through this, I am not saying anything terribly new in saying that, I am simply articulating it in a new fashion, that it is determined as such and from that starting point. When you are dealing with obsessionals, and those who are already dealing with them may know that it is an essential trait of its conditions, of its structure, that not only, as I already announced and said, his own desire dims, flickers, vacillates and vanishes for him to the degree that he approaches it, carrying here the mark of this, that desire was first approached as something which is to be destroyed, because first of all the reaction of the desire of the other was presented to him as something which was his rival, as something which immediately bore the mark to which he reacted with the style of destructive reaction, which is the reaction underlying the relationship of the subject to the image of the other as such, to this image of the other insofar as it dispossesses and ruins him. There is therefore this mark which remains in the approach by the obsessional to his desire, which ensures that every approach makes it vanish. This is what the author of whom I am speaking, and let us say whom I criticize on occasion in what I am in the process of unfolding before you for the past few lectures, this is what the author perceives in the form of what he calls distance from the object, and which he confuses with something that he calls the destruction of the object. I mean that the idea that he constructs of the psychology of the obsessional is that of someone who has perpetually to protect himself from madness. From madness defined as the destruction of the object. This is only, I will explain why, a projection by the aforesaid author of something which is, given the perspective from which he himself operates and wants to get to the resolution of this problem of desire in the obsessional, along the path where he passes, where he conceives it, not only in function of his inadequacies on the theoretical plane, inadequacies of his thought on the theoretical plane, but also because of personal factors, because this is only a fantasy that in a way is necessary. I will show you how through the imaginary perspective in which he tackles the solution of this problem of desire in the obsessional, but it is obvious, commonplace in experience that there is not in typical obsessionals the least danger of psychosis, or that you will lead them to it, and I will tell you why when the time comes. I will be able to tell you why, in the measure that matters are articulated in a way which will show you the degree to which an obsessional differs in his structure from a psychotic. On the contrary, what is perceived in it, precisely although badly expressed, is effectively the following. that the obsessional only maintains himself in a possible relationship with his desire at a distance. What must be maintained for the obsessional is this distance from his desire and not the distance from the object. The object, as we shall see, has in this instance a quite different function. And what experience shows us in the clearest fashion is that precisely he must keep himself at a certain distance from his desire for that desire to subsist. But there is another aspect to this which is the following. It is that insofar as the obsessional, observe this in the clinic and in the concrete, establishes with the other a relationship which, in a certain fashion, is fully articulated at the level of demand. That it is a question of the mother first of all, but in everything else subsequently, and in particular with respect to his spouse, because what does analysis mean for us? That what can this term spouse mean, if not something which is fully articulated at the level of things where we try to situate them? It is namely the one with whom in some way or other one must willy-nilly come back to being the whole time in a certain relationship of demand, someone with whom one is all the time. Even if one keeps one's mouth shut on a whole series of things, is never without pain. The demand demands to be pushed to the limit. What happens on the plane of the relationships of the obsessional with his spouse? It is very exactly the following, which is very subtle to see, as you will notice it, as you will observe it when you take the trouble to do so. The fact that the obsessional spends his time destroying the desire of the other. Every approach into the interior, as one might say, of the domain of the obsessional culminates in the normal case, if one allows oneself be taken in by it in a silent attack, a permanent wearing away which tends in the other, and by the doing of the obsessional to culminate in the abolition, in the devaluation, in the depreciation of what is his own desire. These are nuances, terms undoubtedly whose handling demands a certain practice. But outside these terms, nothing else will permit us even to perceive the true nature of what is happening. I already marked on the other hand, in the obsessional's past, in the childhood of the obsessional, the very particular and accentuated character that the articulation of demand precociously takes on for him. On this schema, you are beginning to be able to understand and to situate it. Because what I already stressed for you by portraying this little child who is always demanding something and who, a surprising thing, has this characteristic among all children who in fact spend their time demanding something, of being the one from whom this demand is always felt, and by the best intention of those in his entourage to be strictly speaking unbearable, the demanding tanon, child, as we say. It is not that he demands more extraordinary things than the others. It is in his way of demanding, it is in the relationship of the subject to demand that there lies the specific or precocious character of the articulation of the demand of the one who already, at the time that this manifests itself at the period, for example, just of the dissolution of the Oedipus complex, in what is called the latency period. This is what is in question. As regards our hysteric, we have seen that to sustain her enigmatic desire, something in her case is used as an artifice, which we can represent, if you wish, by the formation of two parallel and identical tensions at this level of the idealizing, identifying formation with the small other. Think of the feeling of Mr. K for Dora. Every hysteric, moreover, in one of the phases of her history, has a similar support which comes to play here the same supportive role as capital O. The obsessional does not take the same route, the same path. He is even centered on the fact that to manage his problem of his desire he must start with different elements. He must start from elsewhere. What I'm beginning to show you is how, precociously and essentially, It is in a certain relationship to his demand that he can, in his relationship to the other, manifest the specificity and the place, maintain, as one might say, the necessary distance from that which is possible else somewhere, but from a distance, the position of this desire cancelled out in its essence, of this sort of blind desire, as one might say, which is the one whose position it is a question of maintaining. We are going to go over to circumscribe this relationship of the obsessional to his desire. The first thread of it is this specific relationship of the subject to his demand. There are others. Let us observe the following. What is obsession? You know the importance of the verbal formula in it, to the point that one can say that the obsession is always something verbalized. On this point Freud has no doubt. Even when he is dealing with 1-1-1-1-1-1, even when he is dealing with what one might call latent obsessional behavior, he considered that it has only revealed its proper structure insofar as it takes on the form of a verbal obsession. He goes so far as to say that in fact one has only properly articulated the first steps, even in the treatment of an obsessional neurosis, when one has made the subject give to his symptoms what one calls their whole development, which can present itself clinically as a worsening, and what is involved is a kind of destruction of all the obsessional forms in something well and truly articulated. Besides, it is necessary to insist on the character of verbal style cancellation, which is going to start from the structure of the obsession itself, and everyone knows that what in fact constitutes the essence and its phenomenologically anxiety-provoking power for the subject is this. It is that it is a question of a verbal destruction by the word and by the signifier. The subject finds himself prey to this destruction that is called magical. I do not know why. Why not say quite simply verbal, of the other, which is given in the very structure of the symptom. This also introduces us to a phenomenology that it is essential to go over in order to understand its necessity. I would say that just as you have seen here, in fact, the circuit of the hysteric which culminates on the two planes, namely at an idealization or identification in the schema at this upper level, which is only the parallel and the symbolization which occurs on the imaginary plane here. If I allowed myself to use this schema to the limit, I would say that for the obsessional, the circuit is more or less something like this, just as we find it here. I will explain myself. The schema of verbal obsession, the schema which is destructive of the relationship with the other, this fear of causing harm by thoughts, we may as well say by words, because they are spoken thoughts to the other, this obsession of blasphemy, also is something which introduces us to a whole phenomenology which it would be well to dwell on for a little longer. Blasphemy itself, I do not know if you ever took an interest in it. In itself, it is a very good introduction to verbal obsession, this theme of blasphemy. What does it mean to blaspheme? I would really like some theologian to give me an answer on this point. Let us say undoubtedly that it is something which causes the collapse of an outstanding signifier, regarding which it is a question of seeing at what level of signifying authorization, as one might say, where there is undoubtedly situated its relationship with that supreme signifier which is called the unknown, méconnu, Father. It is absolutely not to be confused with it, even if it plays a homologous role, that God has a relationship with signifying creation as such, is not to be doubted, and that blasphemy in its essence is something which is absolutely situated only in this dimension, namely in something which causes the collapse of the signifier to the rank of object, which identifies in a way the logos with its metonymical effect, which makes it go down a notch, is something which doubtless is not the right answer, the complete answer to the question of blasphemy, but it is undoubtedly an essential approach for what is involved in obsession, verbal sacrilege, I mean in the phenomenon which is established in the obsessional. Remember the episode of the rat man. This furious anger against his father which possessed him at the age of 4, if I remember rightly, where he began to roll around on the ground crying out, "You towel, you plate," etc. As always, it is again in Freud that we find the most colossally exemplary things, a real collision and collusion between the essential Tao of the other and this something inert. This collapsing effect, as one might say, of the introduction of the signifier into the human world, which is called an object, and especially an inert object, an object insofar as it is only of itself an object of exchange, of equivalence, also moreover, the whole litany of the childless rage sufficiently indicates it. It is not a question of knowing whether he is a lamp, a plate, or a towel, it is a question of the Tao dropping, being destroyed to the rank of object. You will tell me that what is in question in this destruction of the other in verbal obsession is something, and I hope you will permit me to end with this, because we will be obliged to remain there for today. I would say that this something which is happening here and whose whole structure we will see the next time, this something which brings it about that it is only in a certain signifying articulation that the obsessional subject manages to preserve the other, that the destructive effect towards which he aspires to sustain him thanks to a signifying articulation, and think about this, you find here the very texture of this world that the obsessional lives in. The obsessional is a man who lives in the signifier. He is very solidly installed in it. There is absolutely nothing to fear. The signifier suffices for him to preserve the dimension of the other, but it is a dimension which is in a way idolatrized, and its schema gives us this theme which I recall to you from the observation on the rat man. I would say that French allows us to articulate it in a way which, moreover, I began here once. It will not be a surprise for you at the level of the relationship to the other and of the Tao which begins here. What the subject articulates to the other is a "Thou art the one who s me. Tu es celui qui me." And for the obsessional it stops there. The full word, which is that in which there is articulated the engagement of the subject in a fundamental relationship with the other, cannot be completed except by the sort of repetition which a humorist portrayed in the famous "To be or not." And the chap scratches his head in order to be able to continue. To be or not. To be or not. And it is in repeating that he finds the end of the sentence. Thou art the one who's me. Thou art the one who's me. Thou art the one who kills me. Tu es celui qui me tue. The French tongue here gives us the fundamental schema of this relationship with the other. This relationship with the other is founded on an articulation which, in a way, is itself formed on the destruction of the other. But because of the fact that it is articulation, and signifying articulation, makes him subsist. It is within this articulation that we are going to see what is this relationship, this place of the signifying fellows as regard being it and as regards having it, the thing we stopped at the end of this last session, which will allow us to see the difference that there is between the solution which would allow the obsessional to be shown what is truly involved in this relationship to the fellows qua signifier of the desire of the other, or of satisfying it in a sort of imaginary mirage of conceding to the demand for symbolization by the analysis of the imaginary fantasy. This something in whose dimension, as you know, this whole observation unfolds. That which consists in fact in saying to the woman, "You have penis envy? Well then." As Mr. Casimir Perrier said to a chap stuck up against the lamppost, a little bit disturbed. What do you want? And the chap replies, liberty. Well then, you have it, said Casimir Perier to him. And he passes between his legs and goes off, leaving him completely stunned. It is perhaps not exactly what we can expect from an analytic solution. The very termination of this observation, this kind of euphoric, intoxicated identification of the subject, the description which completely includes a masculine ideal found in the analyst, is perhaps something which brings to the subject a change of equilibrium, but certainly not the one which is the genuine response to the question of the obsessional.